Questions? So the final scheduled for Monday, I think it's either at 8 or 3:30. I think two people have talked to me about taking it on Tuesday, which is fine. If you have any slight excuse that you don't want to take it on Monday, that's fine. There'll be some other time to take it. Typically, we've had a help session before the exam, and probably today's the day to schedule it. Do people have preferences? Really? Saturday? Friday, Saturday? So let's first think about whether... So I can't believe anyone wants it Friday night. Is that true? Am I right in that? You would not. So it should be on the list of possibilities. So... Any particular suggestion on a time on Saturday? Saturday. Somebody wanted to vote on Saturday? I can come on Saturday.
Can we do a Sunday?
No, can't do a Sunday.
Do like 2 o'clock.
2 o'clock. Any other kind of suggestions about when you might want to do this? Yes?
Throughout Friday during the day, so it's a study.
It's a study day, so I hear some no's from the background, but they don't get to care. So do you want to substitute the 7 p.m. for, or you want to have that in addition? So I guess you can vote as many times as you want. That's probably the fairest way to do it.
Can we do it Thursday?
Thursday, like at 4 or something like that? I'll put it up Thursday. Yes, there's a limit of one.
Oh,
you don't know me. I just do one. So Thursday 4 is the preferred time, kind of? Doesn't matter, anytime Thursday? Oh, and somebody said Friday at some other time, like Friday at 1. Other hopeful ideas? Yes?
Can we change
it to 6
on Thursday?
Say again?
6 o'clock on Thursday.
So would... You want me to put that as an alternative, or is 6 the best possible time on Thursday? Ready to vote? Okay, so who's for Thursday at 6? You can vote more than once if you want. 7. Who's for Friday at roughly 1? Who's for Friday at roughly 4? Who's for Friday at roughly 7? I told you that wasn't going to fly. Saturday, sometime like at 2. I see 12. So it's probably the other class that's going to decide it. You latecomers want to throw in your 2 bits worth? Nope? Okay.
Nope, we don't really.
Whatever they decide.
Whatever. Do we want to have a quiz?
No.
Quiz 11.
No.
Okay.
Whatever you want.
Unless it's for like a nice quiz.
I want a
group
quiz.
Multiple choice.
Ooh, a multiple
choice.
No.
Just
say
no. Just say no. We'll move on.
Group quiz?
Group quiz?
Group quiz.
No.
Yeah, maybe.
How about a class quiz?
Maybe group quiz.
Easy group quiz.
2 days of group. No, today we're doing stuff.
And then tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow I'm not going to, I wasn't going to have a set of problems, so we'll do that as a group quiz. And you can put your scores in for iQuiz. So for sure, the iQuiz would be extra. You want it all to be you do want it to be all. So that probably doesn't count. I'll decide later whether it's all bonus or whether at least quiz 11 counts like a quiz. But you're all going to get them all right anyway. So.
We all need a little boost.
Nah, I don't think so. I think quiz 11 is a quiz. The iQuiz will be bonus. So I'm not gonna. So the plan for next time is just to do iQuizzes, and I guess now quiz 11 as a group.
Oh, will it be conceptual?
Yes.
How many?
So I just did a rough proportion of what an extra 5/7 would be, and it turns out it would lead to a total of 24 multiple choice questions, and I think it was 8 problem questions. Or was it 9? I can't remember. For the final.
Are you taking these from previous tests? Are they all fresh?
So I'm really uneventful at this point, uncreative at this point. So while I don't say that nothing will be new, I do say that I will probably have lots of repeats. I would expect at least half of the multiple choice questions will be pretty much pure repeats from the previous ones. However, I will pick ones that people missed in high proportion. Questions? Yes.
So, do we just have a final that's for this section, or is it the same? Like, can we all make one?
So it's not a multiple—I forget what they call that—multiple section time. It's at our normal time, but if you want to come to the other class, that's fine.
So it wouldn't be the same as Whitten's final.
Correct. Won't be. So your final—you have your choice of doing it. I think it's at 8 o'clock on Monday, or I think it's at 3:30 on Monday. Yeah, so just as a normal test is totally different between Whitten and me, this test will be totally different between Whitten and me. More questions? Okay, so pretty light day for equations, right? So we had kind of just two important equations. The context for this was waves. So we said that the wave velocity, the wave speed, was the wavelength times the frequency. And we then knew what a wavelength was. It was the distance between two crests. Frequency is just what it's always been. It's the number of cycles per second, or one over the period. And for waves on a tight string, kind of like that, what we said is that the wave speed was the tension divided by the mass per length. And the book denotes the mass per length with the Greek letter mu. And of no particular importance, but it came up in some of the problems, the word transverse wave refers to a wave like this, where the physical motion is up and down, even though the wave is moving horizontally. So transverse corresponds to the actual motion of the particles is perpendicular to the motion of the wave. And longitudinal is the reverse case, where the motion of the particles are in the same direction as the wave. And in the problems, we saw the Doppler effect, and we'll come up with equations for that next time, or next in 106. But for the time being, you should just know that if we have things that are approaching, whether it's the source that's approaching you or whether it's the listener that's approaching, the result is the frequency is increased. And if things are moving apart, the result is the frequency is decreased. Questions? And I guess there's one other thing on this board that I didn't mention. So if you're taking 106, you can, if you want, pick up the lab manual today. Labs will start on day one, so you want to, if you're in a day one lab, you probably want to pick up that lab manual. The first lab doesn't have a pre-lab, and it's a little bit different, so it's not going to literally kind of pick up from nothing. But the lab manual is there to be grabbed. Questions? So the topic for today is interference. And so let's start with kind of a simple idea of a wave, if we can get it in focus. So if this was a wave, we'd have these peaks. It would be moving at some kind of velocity. And we would, of course, describe the amplitude of these waves, that is to say the distance from equilibrium and the wavelength, all of that sort of good thing. Now, it's not of much import, but if we wanted to describe that wave mathematically, we could do it by saying that the height, let's call it y, was some amplitude, and this is clearly a trigonometric function, so there's going to be cosines, and it's changing in both space and time. So inside this cosine, we're going to have terms that correspond to things moving in space and time. So if we go through one wavelength in x, we're going to increase the number of radians by 2 pi, and we'll go through a cycle. If we increase the time by one period, we're also going to go through a cycle. And this wave turns out to correspond to a wave that's moving in the positive x direction at a wave speed, which is, of course, given by the frequency times the wavelength. And the frequency is 1 over the period, so another way of saying it is that. So probably the signature characteristic of waves is a property called superposition. And what this principle means is pretty straightforward. If you have a series of waves that are coming out from one source, and you have a series of waves that are coming from another source, they just kind of go through each other. And so the altitude of the wave, say at that point, would just be the sum of the altitude that you would have by that wave alone plus the sum of the altitude that you would have by just that wave alone. So it means waves just add up. In some sense, they don't interfere with each other, but in fact, we're going to use that word interfere to describe what just pure addition means. Okay? So superposition just means the waves add up perfectly normal fashion. So let's think about a particular possibility. So let's say that we have one wave that's moving one way and another wave that's moving the other way, and we have them simultaneously present. Okay? So you might think about on the string, I have one set of waves that are going this way and another set of waves that are going that way. What's that going to look like? All that's going to happen is the waves are going to be the sum of these two possibilities. But that's going to work out a little bit different from what you might think. Okay, so here's kind of the starting point. And if things just add up, that would mean that we would have, normally this crest, let's say it's going to be 3 centimeters. Now it's going to be 6 centimeters, right? Everything's going to be bigger. And here we have nothing plus nothing, so it's still going to be nothing. And here we have -3 -3, so here it's going to be small. So the result is, at this particular moment, the waves just get twice as big as they would otherwise. So this is called constructive interference. Things are adding up. So if we think about the situation a little bit later, now things aren't going to add up quite so much. Right, because when this guy is present, we have nothing. When this guy is present, we have nothing. Probably we're going to get a moderately big peak at about that particular location. So we still have constructive interference, but things aren't going to be as big as they were before. So let me kind of sketch out what I've said. We have a big wave at this time. Now we have a slightly smaller wave. But if we continue this process along as these waves move in different directions, they seem to want to stick. If we reach that situation, then we're going to have this wave being plus and this wave being minus. And if you look through this, that means we're going to get exactly nothing. Everything is going to exactly cancel out. So that's going to be destructive interference. And it's kind of hard to see, but you can see that as these waves move their separate waves, we're going to get destructive interference followed by constructive interference followed by destructive interference. What exactly is that going to look like if we kind of really put these things together? Well, so here's a bit of mathematics that tells us what this thing is going to look like, and it's really kind of surprising. And it's all based on a trigonometric identity that you probably don't remember. If you have the cosine of any angle A plus the cosine of B, it turns out the result is kind of funny. You get the cosine of half of A plus B and times the cosine of 1/2 of A minus B, and overall twice as big. Okay, so if I have a wave that's going this way, let me call that big thing B. If I have a wave that's going the other way, then I'm going to have A cosine of 2 pi over lambda x plus 2 pi over the period times t. So let me call all of this B, or excuse me, call all of this A. And what I'm going to get here is A plus B. And what that means is that the time dependence is going to totally cancel out. So we're just going to end up with 2 pi over lambda times x. And if we look at what A minus B is going to give us, if we subtract B, now the x part is going to go away, and the time part is going to add, and we're going to get something that is cosine of 2 pi over the period times t. So this all looks, I don't know, maybe just like mathematics. But let me kind of remind you what we've got. We've got one wave that's going this way, and we're adding that up with another same period, same wavelength, same amplitude wave that's going the other way. And the result is something that's a little bit funny. That is to say, if, for example, the cosine is zero, then that means that the amplitude is going to be zero every place. As this term starts to be non-zero, then we can start to see the cosine term. And if we wait a little bit longer, everything will be flat again, and then we'll have the cosine build up in the opposite direction. Okay, so instead of the time being factored in with the x, which makes for motion, the time is separate from the x. And so we have flat, big, alternating in time. The peak will occur at exactly the same location all the time. So this is called a standing wave. Okay, so let's see if we can make these sorts of situations. So what we need are waves that are going this way and that. And the easy way to do that is to have them bounce off of something. So I'm going to make a wave here, and it's going to bounce off of the far side. And by turning a knob, I can change the frequency of that wave. Let me get down here to where I know it's going to be. Okay, so this is a standing wave. Here we have, generally speaking, a big amplitude, but sometimes it's absolutely flat. This is called an antinode, where we have a big amplitude, but here there's never much of anything. So this thing is a node. And obviously the way, maybe it's not obvious, but if you think about it for a second, if you were to take a picture of that wave, particularly when it's not zero, it would look like that. What happened? Oh, this thing turns off automatically? Or did I turn it off? Something bad happened. Okay. So this was at a frequency of 12 hertz. Okay, so these spots where we get big stuff, that's an antinode. Node is a complicated word for zero, so these spots where we would get nothing, this is called the node. And usually this is kind of written in books like this with the understanding that the wave is going through all possible in-between spots. And it has a particularly big amplitude here and a small amplitude there. Okay. And from my original picture, I hope you can see that the wavelength of this wave is the full length of the string. Okay, so let's kind of make a chart here of the frequency. So this is what we had, and the frequency was 12 hertz. I'm going to up this to 18 hertz. So now you can see that there are a couple of nodes, three antinodes. The wavelength is now shorter than the length of the string, right? Because the picture would look like this. So here, maybe I'll have one more thing here. So here, if you think about it, 2/3 of the length is equal to the wavelength, right? This piece, 2/3 of it, is equal to the wavelength. And the frequency is 18 hertz. If I go to 24 hertz, I can fine-tune this a little bit. Looks like I get the biggest response actually at 23.5. So now we've got 1, 2, 3 nodes and 4 antinodes. So that would be kind of the picture. And you can see that half of the length is equal to the wavelength. So the wavelength, you can see, is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. The frequency is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. If I increase this to, let's try around 30. Fine-tune it a little bit. So it looks like 29.3. So now we've got 1, 2, 3, 4 antinodes. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 half wavelengths. So this is going to have a wavelength that is 2/5 of L, right? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I need to take two of them to make a wavelength. Okay, so these standing waves all have different frequencies. And I hope you can see that, you know, this is about 6, this is about 6, this is about 6. It looks like the frequencies are increasing as the wavelengths are getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Can we come up with a formula that's going to work for the wavelength? Well, let's do one other thing. Can we make a wave, and it's actually a little bit tricky, can I make a wave that looks like that, that has a wavelength that is 2 times the length of the string? And just guessing, it should occur at about 6 hertz. So let's see if we can get it. Right, so there's a, this happens so slowly that it's kind of harder to see, I think, but I hope you can see there's a big antinode right here in the middle. So if we just label these, note these possibilities, 1, 2, 3, this is 4 and this is 5. I hope you can see that in, if this is n, the frequency of that one is n times whatever the first one was. Right? 6, 12, 18, about 24, about 30. And the wavelengths, if you think about it, 2L divided by N is going to work, right? Because here if I take 2L and divide it by 2, I'm going to get L. Here if I take 2L and divide it by 3, I'm going to get that. 2L divided by 4 is going to give me that. And so it goes. And of course, quite naturally, the wave velocity is going to be the frequency times the wavelength. And so we've got n times f1 times 2L over 2L divided by n. So this is all dealing with a constant wave velocity. And if we knew the tension and the mass of this string, we could figure out what the corresponding frequencies are. Okay, so standing waves are the result of having waves that are going thither and yon. They are standing in the sense that we have definite locations of nodes and antinodes. Right, so definite node there, definite antinode there. And they don't look like they're going any place because they're going both places at once. It's literally just the sum of two waves. Okay, questions? Okay, so let's take a look at some of the homework problems. Okay, so here we've got a steel wire. They tell us the length. They tell us the mass, so we can figure out the mass per length. What tension must this thing be stretched so that the fundamental vibration corresponds to a middle C, which they tell us is 261.6 hertz. Okay, so the first thing we're going to need is the wave speed. And we know that the wave speed is given by the unknown tension. That's what we're supposed to find. And then the mass per length, which is the 4.3 grams divided by the corresponding length. This velocity has to equal the frequency. And they've told us that the frequency wants to be this 261.6. times the wavelength. The fact that this is a fundamental means that this is the sort of standing wave we're looking for. We're looking for a standing wave where the wavelength is twice the length of the string, right? So we just have half of a wave standing on the string. So if you look at this, we know everything except the tension, so we can solve for the tension. So this is 261.6, and twice the length is going to be 1.4 meters. So if we rearrange this equation a little bit, if I take the square of all of this, t divided by the mass per length, that's going to be equal to 261.6, 1.4. That all wants to be squared. So the tension wants to be the 261.1 times the 1.4, all of that squared, times the mass per length. Let's check our units. So what we have here is frequency. So this is going to be 1 over seconds. And we've got meters. And those things are all squared. So we're going to get a meters squared over seconds squared. And here we're going to get a kilogram per meter. So you can see that one of the meters is going to go away. And we're going to have meters, kilograms per second squared. And that's exactly what a newton is. That's exactly what we're expecting to be a tension. Okay, so we got 261.6 and 1.4, and we're supposed to square all of that and multiply it by 4.3 times 10 to the minus 3 and divide it by 0.7, and I get 824 newtons. We're good?
Where'd you get the 2 from?
So that came from the picture. They say the fundamental, and this is what the fundamental looks like. And you can see that for the fundamental, we only have half a wave in our length. So the full wavelength has to be 2L. Okay, so we have somebody playing the cello, and currently it's out of tune. Orchestra A is 440 hertz, and she's apparently playing 449. The string is 6.8 centimeters long, and her finger is on it, so the effective length is going to be 20 centimeters shorter than that. And the question is, how far do you have to move your finger in order to get to 440 hertz? So we want to go to a lower frequency. So do we move our finger towards the nut or away from the nut? See again? Towards the nut. I like it. So the picture is, and here's the nut per se. Here's the string. We've been told that this thing is 68 centimeters. But more importantly, her finger is at 48. And the frequency is currently 449, and we want to go to orchestra A, which is 440. Okay. So what's constant in this process? Well, it's the same string, and it's under the same tension. So what's constant is the wave velocity. So the frequency of the fundamental we've seen that the frequency times the wavelength is supposed to be equal to the velocity. So we can set this up as a P1 V1 over T1 equals P1 V2 over T2. Right? The length of the string, well, let's not do it that way. The wavelength of the string times the frequency has to be the new wavelength times the new frequency. Okay, so how long is the wave originally? Well, it's 2 times 48 centimeters, right? Because the fundamental has a wavelength that's twice as long as the length of the string. The frequency is starting out at the wrong note, 449, and we're trying to get a frequency that is 440. So this is maybe bad notation, I see. So typically we use the subscript to indicate which standing wave we're on. And that's not what I'm doing, right? The subscript is indicating a different situation here. We're okay on that? Okay. So the new situation, that version of lambda, has to be the old version times the ratio of frequencies. Okay, so the new wavelength is going to be 449. 440 times 48 times 2, which is, whoa, some major problem. 449, 440, and then 48 times that, 2 times that, I believe that. Basically 98. And if the wavelength is 98, that means the length of the string needs to be half of that. And that's 49 centimeters. So the cellist needs to move her finger out 1 centimeter in order to shift the tone to orchestra A. Okay, so we've got a standing wave kind of like this, and with 5 segments, it's oscillating at 630 hertz. What frequency should we set things up so it would be oscillating in 3 segments? So here is the situation, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, where it's going in 3 separate segments, and we want to have it being going into 3 equal segments. So we can, of course, set up the equation that, again, these are subscripts are going to indicate different situations. Well, no, I can use the subscripts, I guess. So lambda times the original situation in which we have 5 loops times the corresponding frequency has to be equal to the wavelength where we have 3 loops times the corresponding frequency. So if we have 5 loops, a wavelength is equal to 2L divided by 5. And we're told that the frequency is 630 hertz. If lambda is equal to 3, then we know that the wavelength should be 2L divided by 3. So the only thing we don't know in that equation is F3, which is exactly what we were supposed to calculate. Notice that they didn't tell us the length of the string, which is always worrisome, but it cancels out. So we don't actually need to know the length of the string. So what we've got here is 2/5 of 630 has to be 2/3 of the unknown frequency F3. Might as well cancel out those twos. So we have F3 is lower 3/5 of 630. Kind of another, maybe faster way of getting it is if we know that we have a frequency of 6:30 and 5 loops, then we know that the fundamental is that frequency divided by 5. And once we've got the fundamental frequency, we can just build it up by a factor of 3. Right? So 6:30 divided by 5 is the fundamental frequency. So in terms of numbers, we got 6:30, 3 times that, and 5 divided by it. 378 hertz. Okay. So they are telling us the mass per length, and they're telling us the length. So we're going to compute the mass density. We're just going to divide those two things. Then we have to figure out the tension that's required to produce the desired fundamental. Well, actually, in the end, we're going to calculate the density. I guess we're going to start by calculating the velocity that's required to get a desired fundamental frequency, and then calculate the tension and find out all the rest of these things. The last part of this question is to remind you that the wavelength on the string is totally different from the wavelength in the air, right? So the cello is going to make sound. Sound is a wave. The wave speed of sound is different from the wave speed on the string, and so they're going to have different corresponding wavelengths. Okay. So if we're in the fundamental, that means the string looks kind of like this, right? Oscillating back and forth. And so the wavelength has to be twice the length of the string itself. And we know the frequency we want. The frequency we want is given to us as 41.2 hertz. So it's a plug and chug to figure out what the right velocity is, right? Because the velocity is just the wavelength times the frequency. So we've got twice the 1.1 meters times the frequency. We can spend a second talking about units, right? So this is in meters, frequency is per second. So we're going to get out a wave velocity that's meters per second. Whoa, I did something wrong. So I get a wave speed that is going to be 90.6 meters per second. And I know that this wave speed is going to be the tension divided by the mass per length. So they actually asked us to calculate the mass per length first, but it's too simple to spend much time on. We do have the 25 grams expressed in kilograms divided by the length of 1.1 meters. Okay, so the square root of t divided by the square root of this mass per length has to equal this 90.6. So the tension squared, if I square this whole equation, the tension divided by the mass per length has to equal this side squared. So the tension is going to be the mass per length times the wave speed squared. We can check our units. We have kilograms per meter, and this was meters per second squared. So we're going to get kilogram meters per second squared, which is a newton. Perfectly good unit for a tension. Okay, so plug and chug, we've got the 0.025 kilograms divided by the 1.1 meters. All of this times the 90.6 squared. Got the 90.6 in my calculator, 0.025 times it, 1.1 divided by it. And I get a tension that is 187 newtons. Good, because that's not what I had in my notes. So how did I misread that? Oh, I see. Yeah. So you know how these string instruments work. A certain amount of that string is going to be coiled up around the nut, right? So the effective length of it is going to be 1.1, but the full length divided by the mass is what we needed for this. Thanks. Okay, so start again. No.
That's what you have in the velocity calculation.
Ooh. Did I do everything wrong? I think I did. Yes, I did everything wrong. Luckily, I didn't bother to write down the velocity here, so I was okay. So, this is probably clear to everyone except me, maybe. So here, if we wanted to figure out what the mass per length of the string is, we would typically weigh the entire string and divide it by the entire mass, even though some of this mass is wound up here. But in terms of the wavelength that's going to be produced in the fundamental, it would be the distance between these two pegs. Okay, so the mass per length is characteristic of the string, and if I get it right this time, it's that. Check it one more time. Oh, wait, no, so this doesn't change the velocity, right? Because, so this was all part of one equation, right? We weren't using this yet. So the only time we played a role in this is this time at the end. It's the first time I've used the mass per length. Okay, so 90.6, square it, 0.025, times it, 1.35, divided by it, and now I get 152 newtons. And that's what I have here.
So why do we use 1.1 in the velocity calculation?
So this equation is from last time, right? And we needed the wavelength. And the wavelength depends on the distance between these posts, right? It doesn't depend on how much string I have wound around this peg here. Is that good? So in particular, in the fundamental, the wavelength is going to be twice the distance between these pegs, independent of how much is wrapped around here. Okay, so what's left to calculate? We got the tension. So we did things, so I'm not sure why they had us do them in the order they did. We calculated the wavelength of the string's vibration first, right? It had to be twice the length. What's going to be the length of the wavelength in sound? Well, it's the same frequency, right? We're going to hear it as this particular note at 440 hertz. So the frequency is still this 41.2. The speed of sound, they tell us, and they're going to prove it to us in the next chapter, is 343 meters per second. So the wavelength is the velocity divided by the frequency. So we've got 343 and 41.2. And here we have a wavelength that is 8.3 meters. And that's to be compared to a wavelength that was 2.2 meters in the string. Okay. Same frequency, different wavelengths because they're in different media. So the same way it works with if you try and hear underwater, right? The velocity of sound is a lot faster in water than it is in air. But if somebody is playing the orchestra above the water, it's going to sound perfectly normal. The same frequency, different velocities correspond to different wavelengths. So the last problem is here to remind us of a little bit of mechanics. So here they have a particular setup where the mass is not hanging directly off either one of them. So we're going to have to do a little free body diagram to figure out what's going on here, to figure out what the tension is. And we're going to have to do a little bit of trigonometry to figure out what all of these dimensions are. And they tell us that they're going to be I cut off that piece of the thing. The question is, what frequency is this going to be if we have exactly this standing wave pattern that's shown in part B? Okay? So they've picked kind of a funny way of giving us all of this information. They tell us that the total length of the string is 5 meters, but that the distance between those two supports is 2 meters. So if there are 2 meters here and 5 meters total, that has to mean that there are 3 meters hanging off the edge, or 1.5 meters on either side. And we have some tension here, we've got some tension here, and we've got a weight which is equal to 12 kilograms times G. So we're back to breaking things up into their x and y components. We've got a y component for this vector and an x component for that vector. And I think it's perfectly clear from the symmetry that the x components are going to cancel. So we really only have to concern ourselves with the y components. So this y component, I'll call it Fy, that's going to be the tension in the string times the cosine of this angle theta, cosine because it's the adjacent side. So how do we figure out what that angle theta is? Well, if we extend things a little bit, we have that same angle that's part of that triangle. And for that triangle, it's 1 meter on the opposite side, and it's a hypotenuse that is 1.5. So the sine of that angle better be 1 divided by 0.5. And if I know the sine of the angle, I can hit the inverse function to get the corresponding cosine of that angle. Okay, so remembering things from first test back when we were doing vectors. We've got these tensions that are at an angle. They didn't tell us the angle, but they told us the triangle. So we can figure out what the angle is, and then we can calculate what the corresponding force is in the y direction. And of course, it's exactly the same for the other tension. So the upshot then is that 2 times this force in the y direction, which is 2 times the cosine of theta, where again theta is the inverse sine of 1 over 1.5. That has to be equal to the weight that's pulling down, which is mg. So the tension is the 12 kilograms times 9.8 divided by 2 times the cosine of whatever angle I get from the inverse sine of 1 over 1.5. Now you can run your calculator in radian modes or degree modes, whatever you want, as long as you're consistent. I think I'm going to be in degree mode, just because angles and degrees kind of make more sense to me. Let me check to make sure that I'm in degree mode. Okay, so I have 1 and 1.5. Take the inverse sine of it. And what I get is that this is about 41.8 degrees. And I immediately just take the cosine of that and multiply it by 2. And then in the numerator, I've got 12 times 9.8. And I get a tension that is 78.9 newtons. Once I've got the tension, what I know, I can figure out what the wave velocity is. Right? The wave velocity is the square root of the tension divided by the mass per length. And they tell us the mass per length is a nice even number, like a thousandth. So I can take my tension and divide it by 0.001 and take the square root. And I get a wave velocity that is 281 meters per second. And we know from last time that the velocity has to be the wavelength times the frequency. What is the wavelength from the picture? Okay, so can you see that this much is a wavelength? So it's two-thirds. Two-thirds of L, and L is 2 meters. And if you don't want to remember that, you can go back to this picture from the start. So we've got everything we need now to calculate the frequency. So the frequency is going to be the wave speed divided by the wavelength, which is 4/3 meters. And I've got my velocity sitting here as the 281, so I just need to divide it by 4.333333. And I get a frequency of 211 hertz. Okay, so standing waves. Standing waves are not exactly obvious. They come from interference between two waves that are going this way and that, and a trig identity. Right? So a trig identity turned two things that looked like this to where we had separate cosine of x and cosine of time multiplied together. So that corresponds to a standing wave, but we still have the relationship that we've had this time, that the frequency times the wavelength has to give us the wave speed. And we've now had for a while the formula for the wave speed of our string. Questions? Okay, should be good to go. So we're going to finish the vote on this with the other class. I'm going to have a group quiz, groups of three, same groups that you use for the I quiz, on standing waves, right? For the final? Oh, yeah, two sides.